welcome to another episode of the Westminster Confession of Funk, a podcast about storytelling, fatherhood, music, poetry, food, literature, the creative process, theology, and the perils of trying to live the good life. I am Jason Farley, author, teacher, pastor, and publisher at Jovial Press. I want to welcome our cross-politic listeners. I've really enjoyed joining the network here, learning about tent-making, politics, all sorts of things. I hope you consider becoming a club member for a couple of reasons. One, you get the Shotgun Worldview series, which is really good. You'll enjoy that. A lot of food for thought in there. But also, we're going to be giving free Jovial Press books out to the club members very soon. So if you're on the fence, there's going to be some great books going out to all the club members. We are working on getting the Jovial Press books into formats that anyone can open so that we can get them out to the cross-politic club members. So I hope you'll at least consider joining. This week, I wanted to talk about another thing that I've been learning working on my novel. I'm working on a novel, Leprechaun Wars, and I've been reading about creating the antagonist. And one of the things that you find in a lot of different places is that the bad guy should always think that they are the good guy. When they tell the story in their head, they're the good guy, they're the protagonist, and they should always think of themselves as the good guy. But how can the villain be so convinced that he is the good guy? And that's been one of the difficulties that I've run into, and so I've been reading a number of books on creating antagonists, or chapters in books on writing about creating antagonists, and I came across a great way to think about it from a book called The Story Grid by Sean Coyne, and I've been listening to his podcast as well, The Story Grid Podcast, and he has some really interesting insights. He talks about how the best bad guys are the ones that have come across something in the world that they have not liked for whatever reason, and they have created some lie in their head in order to cast themselves in the role of the hero in that situation. And Sean Coyne makes the point that this is actually something we all do. If you pay attention to your own thought process, we all do that. We come across something that we don't like, and we tell the story in such a way that we cast ourselves as the hero. What makes a villain, though? Well, a character becomes the villain when the lie runs into reality, and the lie is revealed for what it is. And instead of conforming themselves to reality, the process goes this way. First, they double down on that lie. And then, as a villain, they try to conform the world to the lie that they tell that makes them the hero. So whatever the lie is, when they double down on it, and then they begin acting to conform the world to make their lie into the truth, that is when someone becomes a villain and not just an antagonist or just a bad guy in a particular scene, but an actual villain. You can see this with Thanos in the new Avengers Infinity War movie. One of the things that makes the movie great is that the whole story is held together by casting Thanos in the role of the protagonist throughout the story. He's not actually the protagonist, he's not the good guy, but he thinks he is, and the story is told in almost from his perspective, as if he were the good guy. But a moment of opportunity comes for him. He has an opportunity to confront the lie that he is telling. It's when he is offered the Soul Stone, but told that he has to exchange his daughter for the Soul Stone. Well, he loves his daughter, but he has to say, I love the truth more than my lie in order to keep his daughter. He can't keep both his daughter and his lie. And he decides that what he's going to keep is his lie. And so he doubles down on the lie and begins to conform the world to his lie in order to justify his continually holding on to it. He's going to prove that this lie is the truth by force. He's going to make the world into the world that in which his lie is true. It's pretty amazing, and the storytelling is really, really well done in that movie. The villain that I'm working on in my novel is a bitter little leprechaun, and he's trying to reconfigure the world through bureaucracy to make the lie that he's telling himself into the truth. And so I've been thinking through the way that Sean Coyne casts villains as characters, and it's been really helpful. The advice for a writer has been really helpful, but man, the thing is it has struck to the heart in terms of self-reflection. It's the sort of thing where you think, oh man, do I really want to keep being a writer? That one hurts. Because how often have I been the antagonist in scenes in my life, or even the villain in my little scenes along the way? Because all it takes is holding on to that lie when you run into the truth. When the world opens up the truth and the lie becomes obvious, but instead of just saying, oh, yep, I am living on a lie there, we hide or we flee our motives and we double down on the lie and begin trying to force the world to conform to the lie that we're telling. There was a time I was driving to church. I was going to be speaking at a conference, and my kids are giggling in the back seat. We've got this red Grand Caravan. They're giggling in the back seat back there. And all of a sudden I hear pop, and it goes quiet. And then they all burst out laughing. And I think, uh-oh, something has gone wrong. And so I turn around, and my kids had somehow, to this day, none of them know how it happened. They squeezed a yogurt in just the right way so that the entire yogurt ended up on the roof of the minivan. I'm laughing about it now, but at the time, I just immediately got angry. And they splattered yogurt onto the roof of the car, and I proceeded to splatter their little souls all over the inside of the van. I was upset, and I hollered at them, and It wasn't a highlight in terms of moments in my life where I nailed the execution. But then, as I was pulling up to church, I'm on my way to go speak at a conference about raising children. And here I am failing at it on my way there. And I have that opportunity to either double down and hold on to the lie, or confess it. And I knew it. I was standing and I was looking at it right in the face. I had acted like the roof of my car was more important than the eternal souls of my children. And I had to humble myself and confess it was awful. I don't like looking at my motives, because as soon as I begin looking in there, I discover how dark it is, and I discover how much of a sinner I am. Nobody likes that. In fact, I've been thinking quite a bit about the ninth chapter of Acts in this very way. And that's where Saul begins the chapter breathing out threats, he's been murdering the disciples of the Lord, and he's on his way to the high priest. And on the road to Damascus, he is knocked off his donkey. He goes blind. And he hears a voice that says, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Now, the question is, why are you acting the way you are, Saul? What's going on? What's motivating you to come and persecute me? Well, his response is, "Who are you, Lord?" Right? He says, okay, he deflects, and he might actually not know. Who are you, Lord? But he says, and the Lord responds, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. It is hard for you to kick against the goads." And Paul's response is not, "Well, let me get back to your original question. Why am I persecuting you? Let me think about my motivations. Let me dig in there and find out what's going on inside me." Instead, he says, "What do you want me to do?" He says, "Well, I'm not really interested, actually, in answering the question of why it is that I'm persecuting you. Just tell me what to do." And he's going to proceed forward quickly, fleeing the opportunity that God is giving him to look at his motives, to inspect the lie that he has been telling. And he said he wants to get right to work. He wants to get right to work, facing out, facing away from his own motivations. And God says, Jesus says, "Arise, go to the city. I'll tell you what to do when you get there." But then he leaves him blind for 3 days, giving him enough time to think through that question. Why are you persecuting me, Saul? Why is it that you're acting the way you are? Why are you, what lie are you holding on to that you need to let go of? After 3 days, we know the story, that the scales fall from his eyes because he's been actually blind and he hasn't realized it. So God blinds him so that he'll realize that he's blind. And it's been the lie of the word of the serpent that has been blinding him, which is why when he finally is healed, scales fall from his eyes, because that's the lies of the serpent that have been blinding him. So he's got serpent eyes that need to be cleared of the lie, because that's what the devil uses, is he uses lies in order to murder. So Paul has been turned into a murderer because he has serpent lies covering his eyes. And God makes that clear, but he gives him 3 days in his blindness so that he can inspect that lie. He can answer that question, why are you persecuting me? Now, here's the thing. You start looking at that question, why is it that I'm sinning the way I'm sinning? Why is it that I'm doubling down on some of these things when I know I'm wrong? When I strike out at my kids, when I speak harshly to my wife, and then I immediately begin making excuses. When I cut somebody off in traffic and I know I was wrong, and immediately stick my hand out and flip them off instead of waving and apologizing, right? We don't want to humble ourselves, and so we immediately begin making excuses, blaming other people, or we attack people, anything really to hide and flee from our own motivations, because it's humiliating. That's what's been so difficult about trying to create this antagonist, this little leprechaun that is bitter, who's attacking and trying to stop and destroy everything. It's really, really humiliating to begin digging into motivations. How does it work? When it comes down to it, God is humbling us when we look at our motivations. Humiliation and humbling have the same root word, because when God humbles us, often we interpret it as humiliation. But it's actually God humbling us, and God only humbles us in order to lift us up. If we humble ourselves in the sight of the Lord, he will lift us up, the scriptures tell us. And so we know that God opens up our motivations and helps us see them, and helps us see those times and places that we have been acting as a villain, not in order to grind us down and destroy us, but so that we'll look at the cross again and see, yes, even these sins, the ones that we did on purpose, these ones that were filled with humiliating motivations, even those sins Jesus died for on the cross. It redoubles our gratefulness for Jesus's death on the cross, for his blood that covers our sin, and for how gracious God really is with us. So thanks for joining me again at the Westminster Confession of Funk. If you want more of the funk, you can check out my blog hosted by Cross Politic. You can check out my books on Amazon.com. And you can visit Jovial Press to find more. Keep it funky, people.